Aslan is like Christ in various ways. He's the Narnian Redeemer in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. He's the Narnian Creator in The Magician's Nephew. And he's the Narnian Judge in The Last Battle.
You're listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, the creator of the show and one of the co-hosts today, as I'm wrapping up a repackaged series on the Narnia Code. This is the fifth and final part, and it contains the final three podcasts from the 2012 interviews. If you listened to the previous program about the Narnia Code, then you know we actually finished the book-by-book exploration of what planetary symbol Dr. Ward believes C.S. Lewis used primarily in the writing of each story. For the last two chapters of the book, he takes a step back and suggests how to understand what's been presented by first using a candlestick and then a telescope to illustrate things. What he hopes will result is that you discover how the Narnia books are even more deeply Christian than previously understood. As before, Dr. Holly Ordway returns to help co-host, and of course, Dr. Michael Ward is the special guest. The last of the three shows I'm presenting today is a Q&A time that Holly and I had with Dr. Ward to tackle some of the most common questions about the perspective he is advocating. If you haven't already listened to the previous podcast in this repackaged series, then be sure to check the show notes for direct links to help you with that task. I'll remind you how to get there at the end of today's show. As before, there will be a brief musical transition to separate the original shows, which are about 15 minutes each.
Today, the chapter from the Narnia Code being examined is called The Candlestick, and provides you with what you might say is a bird's eye view of most of the main themes already explored in the book and this podcast series. Before jumping into that, let me say thanks and welcome back to Dr. Holly Ordway, who is sharing co-hosting duties with me.
Oh, well, it's a pleasure to be here, William.
Also, Dr. Michael Ward is back, and he is the glue, to use another metaphor, that holds this podcast series together. It's great to speak with you again, Michael.
Thank you. It's good that you're sticking with me.
Well, now, let's see. In this chapter, you try to help us understand that Jack, as C.S. Lewis's friends called him, made the Narnia stories about Christ. But you make sure that the reader understands Christ in the fullest sense of the meaning of that word. Tell us more about that and some of how the stories are more deeply Christian than people realize.
Yes, Lewis did say once that the Narnia Chronicles are about Christ. And it's very easily recognized how Aslan is like Christ in various ways. He's the Narnian Redeemer in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. He's the Narnian Creator in The Magician's Nephew. And he's the Narnian Judge in The Last Battle. And that's all well and good and obvious. And in the other four stories too, he's Christ-like in various ways. He teaches people, he guides people, he challenges people, he forgives people, and so on and so forth. And that's all fine. I'm not saying anything against that, but C.S. Lewis had a larger understanding of Christ than simply that Christ was someone who did things to people and for people. He also had an understanding of Christ taken from the New Testament, that Christ was the all in all. He was interested in that verse from Colossians where it says that all things were made through Christ and for Christ, and in Christ all things hold together. He was interested in the understanding of God as the Father of lights, the divine Word who created all things, without whom nothing was made that was made. So how do you get that aspect of Christ's nature into your story, if you're wanting to write a story about Christ? That's a much harder thing to do, to get this cosmic dimension of Christ, or this infinite, eternal, omnipresent aspect of Christ into a story, and yet it's an equally important part of Christ's nature, if we're going by the New Testament testimony. So, that's why I think Lewis used the planetary symbolism the way that he did, because it allowed him to portray Aslan in a particular fashion, as a king, for instance, under Jupiter, or as a commander under Mars, but it also allowed him to fashion the whole plot line and any number of ornamental details in each story as well, so that there's a coherence between the Christ character and the other characters, and indeed the whole description of the cosmos and the events and the details within each chronicle. So there's this harmony, there's this resonance, there's this symbolic unity running through each story, which Lewis thought was a good reflection, imaginatively speaking, of the true situation that obtains in the actual universe, where there is necessarily a harmony between Jesus of Nazareth, the historical single individual figure, and the rest of the universe. There has to be this connection because the same divine word that is incarnate in Christ Jesus is also discarnate in everything that has been made.
And so picking up on this idea then, it strikes me that this is a particularly important insight for our day, which is so heavily influenced by scientific materialism and this reductive approach, and including, I would say, a reductive approach even among Christians who tend to want to box up the universe and parcel it out and in so doing limit the amount of space really that Jesus occupies. Mm. So how do you see the Chronicles being useful in helping us expand our mental capacity, so to speak?
Well, I think that, I mean, even before one becomes aware of this planetary symbolism, I think that sensitive readers of the Narnia Chronicles have picked up on a certain sort of mystical unity between Aslan and the stories in which he appears. I mean, a good friend of mine, many years ago, long before I wrote Planet Narnia, once said to me, oh, the Narnia Chronicles are marvellous, aren't they? They're works of mystical symbolism. And a lot of people have picked up on this sense that there's more going on in the Narnia Chronicles than meets the eye. But now that people can see the planetary logic, the imaginative logic undergirding each book, then we can see how Lewis believed in this coherence, this Christ-drenched universe, to coin a phrase, and we can begin to apply that to the real universe too. With respect to the stars in particular, I mean, seeing as we've been talking about stars and planets so much, let's focus on stars just for a moment. There's that marvellous exchange in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader when Eustace says to Ramandu, a star in our world is just a huge ball of flaming gas. And Ramandu replies, even in your world, my son, that's not what a star is, but only what it is made of. And that's a marvellous little encapsulation of Lewis's view, that materialist reductionist account of stars, for instance, that they're just large balls of flaming gas, is entirely inadequate, because that's only the material components. What a star is, at a deeper, more central level, is a messenger of divine glory. The heavens are telling the glory of God, Psalm 19. In other words, there's a Christ-focused orientation to creation, the material creation just as much as the animate creation. And it's an awareness of that Christ-focused situation that I think is the main thing to be got out of this planetary symbolism.
Now, specifically regarding the chapter title, you share a verse, as you do for actually at the beginning of each chapter. This time the verse is from Revelation chapter 1, verses 12 and 13, and it makes mention of a gold menorah, or this is a candlestick with Christ as the center or the focal point. While you've been discussing some of the aspects, you haven't necessarily tied into how that relates to a candlestick symbolism. I wonder if you could share about that.
Yes, well, I was just trying to think of a suitable biblical way of summing up all this material. And, you know, that image of the menorah, the seven-branched candlestick in the book of Revelation, seemed to me to be a very apt way of talking about it. It says, I saw a gold menorah with seven branches, and in the center the Son of Man. So there you have a sevenfold object centered upon Christ. And that's a beautiful summary, if you like, of the seven heavens centered upon Christ, as Lewis deploys the seven heavens in the Narnia Chronicles. It's rather like the spirit of the Lord, as it's described in the book of Isaiah, you know, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might, the spirit of strength and fear of the Lord. I think I might have got that slightly wrong. But there's a sevenfold description of the spirit of the Lord in the Old Testament too. And Lewis, describing the planets as a sevenfold spectrum of spiritual symbolism, I think is almost certainly alluding to this biblical understanding of the Lord's Spirit as somehow sevenfold. Seven is the number of perfection in a lot of biblical literature. And here in the Narnia Chronicles, he takes these seven planetary symbols and uses them each in turn as a way of talking about a different aspect of Christ's nature. So we have, just to summarize, we have Aslan as king in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe under the royal crown of Jupiter. We have him as commander in Prince Caspian under the wooden shield of Mars. We have him as golden and illuminating under, in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader under the sun's golden embrace. We have him as the one who teaches children, the children to avoid lunacy and reflect the truth in the silver chair beneath the mirroring moon. We have him as the living word, the living and active word in The Horse and His Boy under the aegis of Mercury. And in The Magician's Nephew, we have him as the creator, the one who encourages laughter and heals Vigory's mother, the Venus story. And in The Last Battle, we have Aslan as the one who teaches the children this dreadful lesson, a necessary but dreadful lesson under Saturn, that it is that blessed are those who die in the Lord.
One of the things that you mentioned in that chapter is the value of having more than one mental image of God, something Lewis himself talked about.
Yes, Lewis was very keen that we should have a whole variety of different images, each correcting and relieving the other, so that we wouldn't fall into the trap of having effectively a graven image. You know, one of the great commandments in the Old Testament is against idolatry, but it's just as possible to have a mental idol as it is to have a literal, physical idol that you bow down and worship. Lewis's point was that our idea of God is not a divine idea. We have to think about God by means of words and symbols, but we should never mistake our words and symbols for God himself. Our words and our symbols are, if you like, sacraments of divine presence. We can find God in them, but we mustn't confuse God for them. God is always larger than any mental formulation we can make. And so by having a variety of different images, seven in this case, we're less likely, Lewis hopes, to fall into that trap of idolatry. And so when we're tired of thinking about God as king, for instance, under Jupiter imagery, we can start thinking of him as life, or under Venus, or light under the sun, and so on and so forth. And of course, this is entirely scriptural practice. The Bible itself is full of any number of images trying to teach us some aspect of the divine nature. But no particular image must be treated as if it defines God. You cannot, by definition, define God, because God is infinite. And to define something is to put an end to it. But as soon as you put an end to God, you have ceased to worship God.
One of the other things that I enjoyed in this chapter was you point out that what questions we are asking is important. It's not just the what and where questions are, or how, but we need to not forget the why, the who, and the whom. I wonder if you would address that briefly.
Yes, that takes us back to the question about what are the stars. I mean, are they material configurations of gas and rock, or are they divine messengers? It's not actually the case that they are either one or the other. They can be both. But the point is, the sort of question you ask of the material universe will depend upon the sorts of answers that you think are conceivable. Science as it has developed since the 16th century, is increasingly concerned to ask questions that begin with a what, or a where, or a how. You know, what are the stars made of? Where are they located? How do they move? Questions of matter and motion and mechanism, and those are all fine questions. But they are not the only set of questions that you can ask. You can also ask, why are there any stars at all? who made the stars? Whom were the stars made for? And there you have questions which raise issues of personhood and purposes and points and plans. And then you're into a whole different ballgame of philosophy and theology, not just physical science. So we want physics, of course, but we also want metaphysics. And it's a mistake to think that physical science is the only set of questions we can ask. In exploring this whole topic, I came across any number of words that Lewis used with a double meaning. Words like tingle, which is an old word meaning star, and influenza, and venerable, and commerce, and lunatic, and disaster. All these words have a double meaning connected to the old view of the stars as containing attributes and personalities and qualities. And one particular word that is fun to, that Lewis had fun playing with, is the word consideration. Because he says in one of his academic books that, I hope no one will think I'm recommending a return to the medieval understanding of cosmos. I'm only suggesting considerations that may induce us to regard all cosmological models in the right way, respecting each but idolizing none. And that's Lewis having a quiet joke, because the word consideration comes from con, meaning with, and sidus, meaning star. So to consider something means not just to think about it, but, as it were, to think about it with the stars. It's a term originally in augury or astrology. So when Lewis says, I'm only suggesting considerations that may induce us to think about cosmological models in these ways, let the reader understand. There, hidden in Lewis's own terminology, is an old term from pre-Copernican cosmology, which we won't properly understand unless we are acquainted with that old discarded image of the heavens.
Well, that's going to be all the time we have for this chapter, and that is a very good aspect that you mentioned, and there are other things as well, so we encourage people, if they don't have the book, to get it. Next time, we're going to be looking at the telescope, and you're going to help us to understand how something invisible is actually possible to see and how we can hear silent music. Michael, it's been several programs since you've mentioned your website, so I wonder if you could take a moment to give us the addresses again.
Thank you, yes. The main website is planetnarnia.com. There's also narniacode.com. And then my personal website is michaelward.net.
Well, welcome to our podcast series of The Narnia Code with Dr. Michael Ward. And co-hosting with me is William O'Flaherty of EssentialCSLewis.com, and I'm Dr. Holly Ordway from Houston Baptist University. And so in this episode, we wanted to pull together some of these ideas. And so the question that I wanted to ask first is the big picture question, which is we've been working through Lewis's structure and the different planetary images that he uses. And my question then would be to say, can you articulate, why does this matter? Why is it important for us to understand that he structured it this way?
There are several answers to that question, I think. One is, in a sense, it doesn't matter. You might be surprised to hear me say that it doesn't matter, seeing as I've spent so much time explaining that it does matter. But when I say it doesn't matter, all I mean is that this explanation is literary criticism. And literary criticism is always secondary to the literary text that it is critiquing. It's ancillary. It serves the text. And you can read the text without any knowledge of literary criticism, and that's fine. The stories exist in their own right, and they don't depend upon any literary criticism in order to be, you know, explicable or legitimate. So that's what I mean when I say it doesn't matter. You can always read the Narnia Chronicles without any understanding of this scheme, and you will get a lot out of them. But it does matter that you understand this as well, I think, because it explains that the books are not just a hodgepodge or a random mishmash of carelessly assembled mythological traditions. It shows that the books are very carefully assembled. So it should increase one's respect for C.S. Lewis as an author. It should help account for why the books have become so popular, I think, because it helps explain that although we may not have consciously recognized it up until now, we will probably have sensed it intuitively that these books do cohere. These books do have an imaginative logic, and this explanation helps account for that. So you've got, you know, a biographical reason why it matters. It will affect our view of Lewis. You've got a literary reason. It will account for why the books have been so successful at a literary level. But the main reason why this matters is because it helps explain Lewis's view of Christ and the cosmos, that there is this link, this harmony, this resonance between Christ and the universe that he inhabits. He demonstrates that symbolically by his use of the planetary symbolism in Narnia, and he does it because he thinks that reflects the real situation in the actual cosmos. And that's a very, very important point. I mean, that there's hardly a more important point than that. It's a total view. It's not just a world view, it's a world's view. It's a cosmic view. And Lewis once said that if you have religion, it must be cosmic. There's no sense in thinking about Christianity as just some little kind of religious practice you might do on a Sunday morning. It's got to inform the whole of your life, your mental life, your spiritual life, your physical life. Every part of life must come under the domain of Christ's lordship. And that's, I think, without being too grandiose about it, that I think is why it matters that we understand what Lewis is up to here.
Now, at the end of the last chapter, you comment about how we can see things that are invisible, how we can hear silent music. You titled this chapter, chapter 12, The Telescope, and then you tie back in or mention again about the discovery of Neptune and how that relates. Could you talk about that?
Yes, Lewis was very interested in the way that the planet Neptune was discovered in the 19th century by the astronomer John Couch Adams. Actually, there's a big debate about whether it was Adams or a French astronomer, but for the sake of simplicity, we'll just focus on John Couch Adams, who was this Cambridge astronomer who worked out that Neptune must exist even before he had observed it in the night sky. And you would think, how can you possibly discover a planet without actually observing it? And John Couch Adams deduced that there must be this planet, which was eventually called Neptune, rotating round the sun just beyond the planet Uranus, because the orbit of Uranus was not perfectly smooth, and he realized there must be a planet beyond Uranus pulling it out of a perfectly smooth orbit. Not only did he, you know, correctly identify the existence of this planet, but he actually worked out where it was located before he observed it, just by using reason and mathematics. So Lewis wrote about this in his book Miracles, and he said that if an unobserved planet can make itself known to the human mind simply by the processes of reason and mathematics, think about the invisible God who can make himself known to us through the Holy Spirit. God can come down to us just as Neptune can come down to John Couch Adams, as it were, through this spiritual medium of reason, in John Couch Adams' case, but through the spiritual medium of the Holy Spirit, in the case of Christian belief. We can perceive things which we cannot see. We have an example of that with John Couch Adams and Neptune, and if that's the case with physical objects, well, why should it not be the case with the divine object?
And one of the things that I liked in that example that you drew out was that if someone were sitting next to him, observing him think, they would have seen no exterior evidence that he was thinking these things. And that's something that a lot of skeptics will say about Christian experience, that, well, you say you've experienced the presence of God, but how can I tell? And I think that goes along with what Lewis has written about looking at and looking along, that here we have an example of looking along, in a sense, when the astronomers working out the position of and the existence of Neptune, looking at him, we would never recognize it. Now, in this case, we can then look at Neptune eventually and realize it was correct. But that whole idea of perspective is really the same thing.
Yes, it is. Yeah, quite. I mean, there's John Couch Adams sitting in his Cambridge observatory thinking these thoughts, and into his mind is coming the existence of Neptune, as it were. But if you're an astronomer sitting next to John Couch Adams, just observing him think, maybe, you know, subjecting his mind to some kind of MRI scan, you would have seen little flashes of electrical impulses and neurons firing in his brain. That would have been your external account of his brain activity, but that would tell you nothing about the existence of Neptune, because you're not actually inside the thinking process. You have to enjoy that thinking process in order to get the full revelation. And likewise with Christian belief, you have to be inside the beam of faith in order to perceive what is to be perceived. So a scientific approach to religion, I mean any religion, not just Christianity, but obviously we're here talking about Christianity, a scientific, an external approach to Christianity can never see what the Christian can see, because it's not operating by the same paradigm, it's not working from the same premises. So it's not surprising that often Christians and non-Christians just talk past each other, and they cannot understand each other. They cannot explain what it is that they are seeing, because unless you realize that there is this paradigm, this clash of paradigms, there's no way of actually persuading a non-Christian into the Christian position. He's got to change his whole ground in order to come to a Christian belief. And you cannot actually get him to a Christian position while he's still on his own territory. That's the point. In other words, you know, it's by the Holy Spirit that we recognize who Christ is. We cannot work it out from our own position, as it were. And that's all, you know, that's very standard Christian theology, but Lewis very interestingly connects it back to an astronomical example, which just again shows how deeply informed his whole mind was by questions of the stars and the planets and telescopes and astronomy.
You share two quotes from Mere Christianity in your chapter here, where you deal with the question of, in order to know God, what do you have to do? Do you have to do right things and live cleanly and be a good person? And you say the answer is yes and no, and you share those quotes. I wondered if you could share some about that.
In Mere Christianity, Lewis says that, you know, when it comes to knowing God, the initiative lies on God's side. And if he doesn't or won't show himself, nothing we can do will actually enable us to find him. And in fact, God shows much more of himself to some people than to others, Lewis says. Not because he has favorites, but because it's impossible for God to show himself to a man whose whole mind and character are in the wrong condition. Just as sunlight, though it has no favorites, can't be reflected in a dusty mirror as clearly as in a clean mirror. So, there you have the yes and no answer. That, do we have to be good in order to know God? No, because nothing we can do will reveal God to us if God doesn't wish to be revealed. But, yes, we do need to live as cleanly as we possibly can, because then when God chooses to show himself to us, we will see more of him, as it were. And when we come to know God, obviously we wish to be as clean as possible, because we are now, you know, getting into the relationship business, as it were. We are beginning to, you know, in theological language, we are beginning to show fruit from our life. We're beginning to demonstrate works from our faith. Those two things are inevitably linked, and you can't have faith without works. You can't have life without fruit. So that's really what Lewis is talking about in that passage from Mere Christianity. In other sciences, he says, the instruments you use are the things external to yourself, like microscopes and telescopes, but when it comes to knowing God, the instrument that you use is your whole self. And if your whole self is not kept clean and bright, your glimpse of God will be blurred, like the moon seen through a dirty telescope.
One of the things that, if we want to address how it's related to how, in addition to needing the Lord, we also need other people, and how it relates to the discovery of the Narnia Code.
Yes, there's one other thing that Lewis says in Mere Christianity about astronomy and telescopes. He says that the one really adequate instrument for learning about God is the whole Christian community, not just individual astronomers, but the whole community of science, so to speak. In this case, the science of Christian faith, the Christian brotherhood, that, he says, is the technical equipment for this science. And it's interesting how theology is sometimes described as the queen of the sciences. In other words, we need the church. We need fellowship. We need one another in order to understand God most fully. Just as, you know, a scientist, an astronomer, will need all his colleagues in that field. He'll need to read the astronomical literature. He'll need to go to astronomical conferences and so on and so forth. So we need to, you know, be members of the body of Christ if we are to see God most clearly. And I end the Narnia Code with that point because my own discovery of this whole planetary scheme came about not because I worked it out from first principles. I was helped to it by two friends, a good friend called Christopher Homewood and a retired bishop called Simon Barrington Ward, who had known Lewis in the 1950s. Both these friends, between them, without necessarily being aware of what they were helping me to, did provide the circumstances in which this brilliant symbolic scheme that Lewis uses to structure the Narnia Chronicles came to light. And it would not have happened without them. So there we have, you know, in my own case, a very clear example of this very point that Lewis is making, that we need one another. And individualistic Christianity is no Christianity, really speaking.
Welcome to the 13th and final episode in a special podcast series on the Narnia Code. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com. Holly and I will be taking some of the more common questions people have asked Dr. Ward about his work. I'm going to start it off with a more general question, which is, how long did it take you to complete the initial book, Planet Narnia? So some of the listeners may not have caught this detail that you mentioned way back in some of the earlier shows. You know, in other words, this wasn't something you woke up with one day and decided to look for a hidden key to Narnia and say 3 months later your book was finished. That's not how it happened, right?
Not at all, no. I was working on a PhD on C.S. Lewis's theological imagination. I spent 18 months researching an aspect of Lewis's imagination, and I wasn't focusing on the Narnia Chronicles at all. And then one night, when I was reading Lewis's long poem about the planets, I had this idea that there was a connection between Jupiter and the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. That was the spark, as it were, that lit up the whole pattern. But it wasn't something I was looking for. It just kind of fell into my lap. I write about the circumstances of the discovery in the final chapter of the Narnia Code, and indeed the final chapter of Planet Narnia, if people want more details. But absolutely, I was not looking for this. And when I stumbled across it, I realized I stumbled across a very interesting thing. So I jettisoned all the work I'd been doing on my PhD up until that point and refocused my work entirely on Lewis and the planets. This was in February 2003, 9 years ago now. And it took me about a further year and a half or so to finish my PhD, and then I rewrote my dissertation as Planet Narnia, which came out in 2008. So from idea to first book, there was about nearly 5 year period, and then a further few years went by before I published the Narnia Code. That came out in 2010. So a further 2 years between Planet Narnia and the Narnia Code. And in the course of all this reading and researching, of course, I was also giving lectures and talks all over the place, and so I began to get a lot of feedback from people, and it was interesting seeing the questions that they had and the problems that some people felt with the whole theory. So that's been very useful because it's shown me what needs to be explained and what particular problems some people have with this whole idea.
Now, you've mentioned at various points both Planet Narnia and the Narnia Code, and I wonder if you might give us a brief overview of how the two books are different and what's characteristic of Planet Narnia as opposed to the Narnia Code, which is what we focused on.
Yes, Planet Narnia is a much longer and more detailed and painstaking analysis of the whole idea. It's basically a doctoral thesis, and it was published by Oxford University Press, and it's got a lot of long words and footnotes and detail, far more detail than many readers of the Narnia Chronicles really want. So that's why I wrote Narnia Code as a more accessible, shorter, briefer, more popular approach for those who want that. The Narnia Code is also more explicitly devotional. It's got a much more intentional Christian angle to it. Planet Narnia is much more purely academic. So those are the main differences. And I've known people who have read both, and some people find that they are both useful in different ways. It's not necessarily the case that you want one or the other. Some people like to have both.
A common question I've heard others ask, now I don't know if they've read either book, an objection that Lewis himself stated that he didn't plan out the entire series, so how can there be some common hidden theme like what you present in your work?
He did once say that he only had one book in mind. When he began The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, he just had that first story in mind and he didn't have the whole series mapped out. And yes, some people say, doesn't this cast doubt on your planetary idea? But my idea is not that Lewis set out with the intention of writing seven stories, one for each planet. My belief is that he set out with the intention of writing a Jupiter story in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. And he did that because Jupiter was his favorite planet, because Jupiter was the symbol that he thought we needed especially to be reminded of in the saturnine 20th century. And there are one or two other reasons as well, which I won't go into now. And then having written The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, his jovial story, Lewis evidently said to himself, well, I've done one, let's do another. And then another. And eventually he decided to do all seven. The question really is, why did he do just seven? And he once said in a conversation with a former student of his that he had had an idea that he wanted to try out. And having tried it out to the full after seven books, it was time to stop. But he never explained what it was that made seven neither too many nor too few. And I think this planetary scheme accounts for that very well.
So one of the questions that we might ask you at this point is, if we've become interested in C.S. Lewis from hearing you talk about his work here, obviously there's his own work to read, but there's quite a lot of scholarship and work on Lewis, which ranges quite a bit in quality, to be honest. And so could you give us some recommendations for people who would like to read some secondary works, some particular highlights?
Yes, I think probably the best book on C.S. Lewis is Walter Hooper's book called C.S. Lewis, A Companion and Guide. At least that's what it's called in Britain. I think in America it might go under the title of C.S. Lewis, A Complete Guide to His Life and Works. If you just Google Walter Hooper, C.S. Lewis, Companion and Guide, it will come up on Amazon or wherever you do your book shopping. And that's easily the best book on Lewis, I think. It's got a brief biography, it's got a summary of nearly all his major works, it's got a key ideas section, a who's who section, a what's what section, and a complete list of all the books and articles that Lewis ever wrote. It's absolutely indispensable. It's way the best book on Lewis available. So I'd go for that, first and foremost. Depends really what you want. If you want biographies, there's a very good biography by George Sayer. Quite a good one by Alan Jacobs. If you want literary criticism, then there's The Cambridge Companion to C.S. Lewis, edited by Robert McSwain and Michael Ward. If you don't mind my puffing another of my titles. Diana Glyer wrote a really good book about Lewis and Tolkien, The Company They Keep. Bruce Edwards edited a collection of essays called The Taste of the Pineapple. That's a really good collection. But there's so much, really. At the back of the Narnia Code, I list certain works about C.S. Lewis and Narnia. I've listed there perhaps 25 or 30 titles, all of which are well worth looking at.
Well, that naturally leads me into even though you do list it in the back of the Narnia Code. Some of the works directly by Lewis, of course, we shared last episode, Mere Christianity, and then you mentioned Miracles. I wonder if there were two or three other key works by Lewis that, you know, that people should especially be sure to read.
Yes, there are three in particular that I would mention if people want to follow up Lewis's understanding of the planets. There's this long poem that Lewis wrote called simply The Planets, which you can find in his collected poems. There's The Discarded Image, one of his academic works, which has a long chapter all about the heavens as they were understood in medieval times, and a very interesting epilogue all about cosmological models. That's a marvelous introduction to the medieval and Renaissance worldview. And then in Lewis's fiction, the third book in the Ransom trilogy, That Hideous Strength, has a chapter entitled The Descent of the Gods. The planetary gods come down to Earth at the end of the trilogy. And the way Lewis writes about the planets in that chapter is simply marvelous. It's a tremendous prose poem, really. And these three sources, the planets poem, the discarded image, and That Hideous Strength, were my three main sources when I was trying to understand how Lewis himself understood the seven heavens.
And I think in terms of articles, you mentioned in your book, especially Meditation in a Tool Shed, On Stories, Essay, as well as It All Began with a Picture. So people would probably find those essays helpful as well, would they not?
Yes, absolutely. Those are three very good essays to begin with. Meditation in a Tool Shed is fundamental to Lewis's whole outlook on this question of contemplation versus enjoyment. On Stories is a marvelous introduction to his view about the importance of atmosphere in storytelling. And It All Began with a Picture is just a brief little introductory insight into the process by which Lewis began writing the Narnia Chronicles. Though there, of course, he keeps his cards very close to his chest about the planetary symbolism. But then, as he says in one of his articles, you should never believe everything an author tells you about how he wrote his books.
Which leads me to the next question. That is, even though we talked about this way back in one of the earlier episodes, some people may not recall that, why you think Lewis would have invented and kept such a secret? You know, is he known for keeping secrets?
Yes, he could be quite secretive when he wanted to be. He kept his marriage secret for the best part of a year, a most extraordinary thing to do. And I would say that a man who can keep his marriage secret can keep a secret about anything. The whole point of a marriage is that it's a public relationship, and a private marriage is really a contradiction in terms. But Lewis married this American woman called Joy Gresham, and nobody knew about it for the best part of a year, not even close friends like Tolkien. But there are many other examples of his capacity for secretiveness. I think we may have touched upon some of these in an earlier episode. But why would he be invented and kept this secret? Well, that again is something we've touched upon in the whole of these interviews. He invented it because it helped him express imaginatively a very important theological belief about Christ and the cosmos. That was why he invented it, and he kept the secret because he had to keep it. In other words, if he had told people that this was what he was up to, we would have stopped enjoying the stories, and we would have begun contemplating them as very complicated allegories of the planets. And that's not how we are meant to understand this whole symbolism. It's not an allegory. It's an imaginative logic. And so some people ask me, well, haven't I now frustrated Lewis's own purpose by bringing this scheme to light? And that's a very good question, but in answer to that question, I would simply say that I've simply done an exercise in literary criticism. I tried to explain the imaginative logic undergirding the stories. And C.S. Lewis himself was a literary critic and spent years of his life analyzing minutely the structure of Paradise Lost and the Divine Comedy and other great works of literature. So he thought there was nothing wrong in analyzing literature. And that's all I've done in these books. The only mistake that could be made about this is if you begin to substitute the criticism for the text. That of course, is not what I'm advising. I'm saying that you should, if you're interested in this scheme, read the Narnia Code, read Planet Narnia, and then next time you read the Narnia Chronicles, you will hopefully enjoy them more richly and intelligently. And that's what literary criticism is for.
Well, exactly. That's an excellent point, because I was thinking about how your book has helped me in a way that, because it's sort of like a magnifying glass or a microscope, helping me to bring into focus details that I wasn't aware of with my own vision, and that now I'm able to enjoy the Narnia stories even more because of it.
Yes, and I find that myself, too. I go back to the Narnia Chronicles now much more appreciative of Lewis's skill as a writer and much more capable of seeing the reason for certain otherwise puzzling episodes and events within the Chronicles. They do begin to hang together much better, I think, once you have this theme in your mind.
Well, it's definitely hard to say goodbye, but this is where we're going to have to end not only this program, but also the entire special podcast series on the Narnia Code. I want to encourage everyone who still has questions to make sure they've listened to the entire series. In fact, I think you need to listen to it at least twice, because the perspective that Dr. Ward shares might be at first foreign to you, so that the first time through your mind is like bringing up too many questions that's distracting you from fully following along with what has been said. And of course, we want to encourage you to read either or both books, The Narnia Code and Planet Narnia, if you haven't already. Now, even though I don't want to do this, I must say my final thank yous to my co-host, Holly. It's been a pleasure working with you, Holly.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to be part of this, William. Thank you.
Now, where can people go to learn more about you and your work?
Well, they can visit my blog, go to hollyordway.com.
All right. And, of course, having so much time with Michael has definitely been a tremendous pleasure. Thank you, Dr. Ward, for your willingness to agree to this project.
My pleasure. I'm really grateful to you, William, and indeed to Holly, for all your care in putting these broadcasts together and your interest in these books. It's a great joy and pleasure when something you write actually excites the interest and attention of intelligent people. So I'm grateful. Thank you.
And I'm sure Michael wouldn't mind me thanking you, the listener, as among the intelligent people, because you've been interested enough to at least listen to this podcast. As noted at the start, this is the final episode of the Repackaged series that was originally 13 shows, but by combining two or three at a time, I made the series just 5 programs. I'm William O'Flaherty, and this is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. Thank you for listening to my program. Please be sure to listen to the other re-release shows if you haven't already. There are direct links to them in the show notes. Also in those show notes are links to the separate websites about Planet Narnia, the Narnia Code, and Dr. Ward's personal site. Plus, the notes have a link to Holly's personal site and the interview I did with her about her spiritual autobiography entitled Not God's Type. You can find the show notes either at EssentialCSLewis.com or allaboutjack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the podcast files are directly hosted. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. If you go to the other location, EssentialCSLewis.com, you can still get to this podcast. Plus, I have a variety of other articles there as well. I hope you enjoyed today's show enough to want to share it. Also, feel free to leave comments about the program online and consider listening to other shows. In fact, in addition to the link about Holly's spiritual autobiography, you will be able to locate the 2 times so far she has been with me to discuss a shorter work by Lewis in an occasional series I simply called an essay chat. Plus, there is a link to the show in which Dr. Ward was also with me on an essay chat. His essay was Myth Became Fact. Again, you can hear those podcasts and others by either going to EssentialCSLewis.com or AllaboutJack.podbean.com. In case you haven't heard, I want to let you know that I have a book coming out in March 2016. It's called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, A Companion and Study Guide to the Screwtape Letters. You can learn more about it by also going to All About Jack, as I recently shared about it. Plus, you can go to ScrewtapeCompanion.com to get a free 20-page PDF sample of the book, as well as pre-ordering it. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, if you have questions or comments, email them to info@EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, that's info@EssentialCSLewis.com.